This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Betches Media presents.
A lot of them aren't even pretending to be insurance.
Slow the testing down.
Remove him from office.
No justice, no peace.
Cast a vote that will make you proud.
The Betches Sup Podcast.
With all due respect, that's a bunch of malarkey.
Hello and welcome back to the Sup Podcast. I'm Amanda Duberman.
And I'm Caitlin Baird.
And today we are here with authors and activists Dr. Yusuf Salaam and Ibi Zaboy. Yusuf Salaam was just 15 when he was wrongfully sentenced in the Central Park jogger case, along with four other teenagers who we now know as the Exonerated Five. Yusuf Salaam is a poet, a prison reform activist, and author with a Lifetime Achievement Award from President Obama, along with numerous other honors. We do a 30-minute podcast, so I can't list them all. Ibi Zaboy is a writer with an MFA from Vermont College of Fine Arts. Among other titles, she's authored the novel American Street, which was a National Book Award finalist, and she also edits the Black Enough anthology. Together, they've written Punching the Air, a novel written in verse about a 16-year-old boy who was wrongfully incarcerated. Thank you both for your time today, and congratulations so much on the book.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So we both had an opportunity to read the book, but we'd also love to hear you each describe it. So can you describe what Punching the Air is about, why you wrote it, and why you wanted to tell this story together through a YA novel?
Well, you know, while I did not live the experiences of Yusuf, of course, but we met in 1999 when we were in college. Well, actually, I was attending the college. Yusuf was as well, because we just found our college IDs. But he walked into a class that was being taught by a former student nonviolent coordinating committee member, SNCC, Professor Marimba Ani, who also worked with the late John Lewis. And she was part of Harlem's activist community back then. And she had invited Yusuf to sit in on her class. And when he walked in, we didn't really remember who he was, although I was in sixth grade when the Central Park Five case occurred. But as soon as I found out, because I was the editor of my college's newspaper, I wanted to get an interview from him. That interview never happened, though we did take a long walk and talk about his case, including the man who was responsible for their conviction. In sort of a backhanded way, who is Donald Trump. I never got that interview, but I ran into Yusuf again in 2017 when my debut novel was published, my young adult novel, and he was selling his self-published book of poetry, and I was shocked that he had not already told his story in a mainstream way. I was in the midst of the conversations around young adult novels and social justice issues. And here he was, having experienced something as a teen, but the world didn't know about it. The Netflix series had not yet aired, and I didn't even know about it. So I knew about the Central Park Five jogger case. It was part of my childhood narrative growing up in New York City. And when I met him, he had not been able to tell his story to a larger platform. And I was a published author. And as they say, the rest is history.
Wow, that's so amazing.
The cool thing about this, too, is that it's an opportunity, I think, for us to give an offering of love, of guidance, you know, through this difficult time as well that we are experiencing, not just the COVID-19, but also oppression, right? Oppression coming to its head, oppression being needing to be defined and some answers being given. And I think Punching the Air is that great opportunity for us. Me having gone through a terrible ordeal, Ibi being a prolific writer, a celebrated writer, able to take my words and massage it into this great book that we all have and that we are experiencing, and that in a lot of ways, as we navigate through life, you know, how do we maintain hope? How do we maintain our dreams? How do we allow for circumstances not to change us, but to help us grow into the most magnificent people that we need to be?
And I have to add that the story features 16-year-old Amal Shaheed, who is incarcerated for getting into trouble one night, having a fight, but the fight ends up in a near fatality, and he is not responsible for that near fatality. And he is sent to prison, and he has to find a way to cope and make it through the next day. While Amal's experiences doesn't reflect Yusef's experience, he is inspired by Yusef as a character and as a person. Yusef is an artist and poet in the same way that, Amal is an artist and poet in the same way that Yusef is an artist and poet. And I was part of the spoken word movement in college as well, so I bring that expertise to the page. And so basically it's a different lens. We're not just talking about the prison industrial complex or mass incarceration. We're talking about a child. This is just not even a bird's eye view, just more of an introspective narrative about what would go on through in the heart, mind, and soul of a child who finds himself in this situation.
Yeah, and that's very... so poetic, appropriately. The book is, what was interesting to me was that I was surprised as I read to start getting mentions of smartphones, Twitter, social media, and other trappings of our current day. And I kind of was wondering what inspired to set it specifically at this time. And how did you decide to capture, how were you able to capture the voice of a modern teenager? Surrounded by very new forces, right? Like, as we're coming of age and adolescence, I was like, I didn't have smartphones. And I graduated high school in 2006, which makes me feel old. But like, it's so different now. And I thought that the voice was so, so close. I was just wondering, like, kind of what informed that decision?
I think it was a collective of our experiences. And also, the ability, I think, to look into the future and what would be this experience of a 16-year-old in 1989. And we both knew what that looked like because we had several experiences that we had been exposed to, whether it was Amadou Diallo, you know, whether it was me in terms of Yusef Hawkins, Yusef Salam. All of these cases, all of these atrocities that were going on and that continue to go on, Emmett Till, you know, modern day Scottsboro Boys becoming the Central Park Five and now the Exonerated Five. I think all of those things, through Ibi's writing, allowed for us to take the past and move it into the present as it informs the future. Because we're still talking about Emmett Till because we have not experienced justice. We're still talking about others in a similar way because in a similar way, we still have not experienced justice. And so it seems like there's this circle going on about what our collective experience is. And I don't want to say it just so happens, but the beautiful thing about our book is that it showed up right on time. All of the stars have aligned. And, you know, in the midst of the desire to be entertained and educated at the same time, our book shows up. You know, Punching the Air is the opportunity for this story to be told and also the opportunity for us to have conversation as it relates to what's going on now.
Yeah. You've set this book more or less in the present, 30 years after the, what you call, Yusef, the criminal system of injustice wrongly sentenced you. As you mentioned, Amal's experience is slightly different to the extent of his participation, but I'm wondering what that says about how you think the system has evolved at all, where you could retell your stories from 30 years ago. And so many things are so jarringly and upsettingly familiar. What does the fact that you were able to center this story in the current day say about the way this system has evolved, if at all?
I think what that says is that the foundation of oppression has not changed. We have changed, right? We have collectively said we want to be the answer to Dr. King's dream. And so as the kaleidoscope of the human family, we will walk arm in arm, hand in hand together into the future. But the foundation of systemic oppression, of racism, of white supremacy, white male dominance has not changed. And I think if we were to predict the future, we would probably be right in saying that it probably will not change. There's been this desire to keep racism going. There's been a desire to keep slavery going. We see it in the founding documents of this country through the 13th Amendment, which is in the book, you know. And we also see it rearing its ugly head through this current presidency and how we have been thinking we've been getting gains in our political progress. We've been thinking that we've been making strides in our humanity, but we've been playing an offbeat tango. 2 steps forward, 18 steps back, you know, and wondering, how do we get here? But we got here because that's part of the design. We've been awakening to the understanding of what we need to do, where we need to be, how we need to show up. But in that awakening, we're fighting against a design that has been perpetuated against us maybe 100 years into our future.
I think I want to add that I started working on this with Yousef, I was talking about it to my teenagers. I have 3 teenagers. Well, they're teenagers now. And I realized that there's a whole segment of American history that they still don't know about or they didn't know about. So they're studying civil rights movement in school. And because they go to a progressive school, they're learning about the Black Power movement with the Black Panther Party, et cetera. And then it ends there. And then in 2012, we have Black Lives Matter and Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown, et cetera. So there is a whole gap in their understanding of racial injustice in this country. They know that civil rights is still a thing. That's they know about Emmett Till. And it goes from Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin. So when they found out about the Central Park Five, it was just an awakening of, wait, this was still happening. And I hadn't mentioned this before, Yousef. I also showed them Cornbread Earl and Me, this 1970s movie. And what was the other one? Coolie High.
Coolie High.
They were both movies set in the 1970s. I think they were set in the late 60s, but were out in the 70s about just Black boyhood. And something happens at the end of each movie that you could kind of guess what that is. And when they saw it, they were like, wait, this was 1970s? You know, and realizing like, you know, for each decade there are incidences that reverberate time and time again that lets us know not much has changed. So we grew up in New York City. So while I watched a Central Park Five case play out in elementary school, before that, there were other incidences. There was, right after the Central Park Five case, there was Yousef Hawkins, and that's what Yousef had just mentioned. There are some others, names I can't even remember. Bernard Goetz, yeah. And a white man who took it upon himself to shoot, was it 4 young black men who he claimed was trying to rob him? They were probably trying to rob him, but the point is, you know, he took it upon himself because crime was so rampant in New York City. And he was hailed as a hero because crime was so rampant. But there were other people coming to the defense of those black boys, too, in the same way that a lot of people did not believe that the Central Park Five did commit that heinous crime because of the overall narrative in the media. And it was so hyper-local in New York City that if you're not from New York City, you didn't know about these things, and which was the case with Yousef and the Exonerated Five. So in that sense, we both had a wealth of experiences to pull from to say, you know what, we can pull from the Michael Griffith case, we could pull from Yousef Hawkins and your case from our childhood, and it's still relevant today. There was also the Genesis 6 case that happened in 2006, And because social media wasn't the way that it is now, we forgot about that. You know, it's not making the rounds anymore, but that was not that my children were born at that time. And those men are still alive to tell their story in the same way that the exonerated five are. So so because of that, punching the air is not just about racism. It is about a boy. And we're going to keep reiterating that because, you know, what the systems are may not change. We're not going to reform or abolish the prison systems. But what can a child do in those situations? How do you hold on to your humanity? And what is it that you do to be an agent for social change, even if you don't experience it yourself?
I think the beauty of that, too, is how we all become light in the darkness. So that even though we are fighting against what may be an insurmountable mountain, we don't just say, okay, we're going to just let the mountain crush us, right? We begin to be, you know, we hold up so that everyone else that's coming and that is coming and that is there can get out, you know, and as much as we can, we then pull ourselves out of the rubble as the mountain crushes down, you know. But that light, that need for us to be able to eradicate darkness is there. And it happens, I think, all the time. It happens when we sit back and try to plan the future and we become, when we hold the idea of what the future could be and how we pass the baton of legacy down to our ancestors, you know, or from our ancestors to our legacy that is coming, which would then be ancestors to someone else. You know, the beauty of that, right? Becoming our ancestors' wildest dreams, the beauty of being able to break generational curses, but also know that we were born in the struggle and born on the side of right because we've been born with this skin, right? And I think that that's the part that's exciting about it all, realizing who we are, where we are, what we are, why we are, and how we are.
You said that this story is about a boy, and I think as I was reading, I got the sense of this broader world being explored through this character's narrative. And it felt actually very familiar because it's in verse, I immediately thought back to like epic poetry, the Odyssey, the Aeneid. And I was wondering if that was a tradition that you considered as you guys were writing. And you're talking about how, you know, life and the world, we're handing down these traditions. That's one of the oldest traditions in poetry. I was wondering if that also informed kind of the sense of legacy.
That's a great question. While Yusuf had a book of poetry, but one of them was very long, I Stand Accused, and he can talk more about that. But unfortunately, that didn't make it into the book, but there are other snippets from his poetry that are in there. But absolutely, this comes from the epic narrative that is told in verse form, which is the oldest form of storytelling. Prose is something that's still very new in our human history. And it's so interesting that verse novels are becoming popular with young people. And I remember telling Yusuf that we can write this in poetry form and explaining to him, like, people do that, right? It's not going to be a collection of poetry, but you can connect each poem and tell and give it a narrative arc. And I had about five poems that I worked my way around, five poems that Yusuf had. That I worked my way, you know, out of five poems came like 30,000 words, but it's really planning those poems and then creating the arc around the character. But absolutely, it is like the Odyssey and the Iliad. It is when sometimes Yusuf brings up this idea of a griot. A jelly is the African word for a griot, like the village storyteller and the keeper of the culture. That is a tradition that we both are coming from, with Yusuf with his speaking and mine with my writing. We hold on to culture and we share it with the people. And the way that we share it is not always in chunky paragraphs, right? We have to make it accessible to young people. And I'm happy that our publisher is printing a special paperback edition to donate to young people who are incarcerated, because they can't have hardcover copies. So they're partnering with a nonprofit organization. And for reluctant readers or struggling readers, this is just an easy access for them into story. Not to say that they can't digest a novel in prose, but this is easy to get to the emotion, to get to the root of the story. So yeah, all of that. And, you know, Yousef was a poet. He wrote poetry. You weren't writing chunky paragraphs about your experiences, were you?
No, they were very succinct. I found that to be as succinct as possible gave me the greater opportunity to get it out. And just to, and when I say get it out, I'm not even talking about getting it out to the world. I'm talking about getting it out of myself so that I can then read it and then it become a key for me, right? Because in many ways, I would reread these poems that I wrote in prison. And these poems gave me a sense of purpose and a sense of stick-to-itiveness that I would have given up had I not had those reminders, you know, the reminders that we are at war, the reminders that, you know, like Ibi said, I stand accused, you know, because at some point there's this desire for you to just say, okay, well, they want me to be the monster. I'm going to be the monster. But I had to remind myself that I stand accused, that I am accused of this. I am victimized in this, in the same way that others have been victimized, right? There are six victims. And back then it was more than six, because we talked about the Central Park Seven and it could have been the Central Park 46. But because it got, so to speak, cut down to the Central Park Five, there were five victims being accused of victimizing a white woman. We actually were all victims of the system, you know? But I had to remind myself of that. I had to be able to tell my story in a way that gave me hope, that spoke to the idea and the possibilities of what could be. And in poetry, I found really an open door, a window to opportunity that I didn't have. It was a means of being able to remain free, even though my body was in bondage.
Yeah. And we can't forget hip hop, the role of hip hop in all of that too, because it is essentially hip hop, and hip hop, early hip hop, our 80s hip hop was storytelling.
Yeah,
they, you know, the song, the bars were all story. The lyrics created a story, and we're also pulling from that too.
It's funny that you say that, and I just want to just say this name just quickly, only because you said storytelling. And I'm thinking about Slick Rick.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Yousef, as I was reading the excerpt that you guys had in Oprah magazine, and I was going to ask, you know, what was it like to inhabit that, your younger self in that time of your life? But I thought there's been so many cultural representations of his experience. You must have had to do that a lot. But you actually did say that you found this somewhat traumatic because you were reliving it in a way that you had not before. So I kind of wanted to pose questions about that to both of you. Evie, did you know that this was really going to be a particularly intense exploration of what Yousef had gone through? And Yousef, what was that like to sort of relive and inhabit your younger self while you were putting the book together?
So I did not. I realized that we had to tell a fictional story, because for me to tell his story, there would have to be some therapy thing going on there. I wasn't ready to do that sort of excavation. And Yousef had mentioned in another interview that when I first asked him for an interview when we were in college, I never got that interview. And he said maybe because I wasn't ready to talk about it, right? And I'm realizing that when we did talk about the working on the book, Yousef would approach his story from a philosophical standpoint. It would be reflective and introspective. And I would have to do the hard work of just like, okay, so what was it like? What was in there? But that required some memory and going back. So I took it upon myself to say, okay, I'm going to have to fill in the gaps. It's enough that I have the worldview, right? So for me, it was craft to get into the skin and the bones and soul of a 16-year-old boy. That wasn't hard for me. I don't know why it wasn't. I know why it wasn't hard. I grew up around boy. You know, I had boyfriends. I was in high school during the height of hip hop, and hip hop was very male dominated, and listening to all those voices and getting the cadence and rhythm of Black boys. I was part of the community. I can just hear what Black boyhood sounds, the depth, the rhythm, the thoughts were already there, and paired that with you, what Yusef shared with me, it wasn't that traumatic for me. I knew that Yusef lived it. I wasn't going to try to have him live it again, because he already did that with the When They See Us, right? And again, this wasn't his story. But I watched, of course, I saw When They See Us. I rewatched the Ken Burns documentary. I also watched the Khalif Browder documentary. And there's a plethora of just content on the internet to just get an idea of what boys, or when boys and girls are experiencing behind bars. So that was part of the research. Research, craft, and interview, basically.
Yeah, especially, you know, when you talk about the trauma of it, there's this liberation that happens when you tell your story. You know, you go through a therapy session that you had been denied, right? And I think part of that denial is also to ensure that you get trapped in that recidivism, you know? And once you're able to remove yourself from recidivism and make something of your life, a lot of times that happens because you've taken your story, you've taken your experience, and you've really just said, I need to put this there. I need to put this behind me so that I can move forward. Because if I keep living and reliving this experience, it is going to break me down. You know, in so many ways, I had to forget. I had to put away, I had to lock up the experience, the trauma of it, in order to be able to move forward. And revisiting some of these were easier to look at it from the perspective of a outside looking in, introspective, being able to, you know, evaluate as not me being inside me, but me saying, this is what happened to Yusef, you know, as opposed to this is what happened to me, because then I was able to really talk about it in a way that I had not been able to talk about it, you know. With regards to When They See Us, seeing my words being played out and portrayed through an actor was extremely traumatic and extremely liberating at the same time, because it gave me the opportunity to quickly revisit, but also deal with it, and then emerge on the other side a brand new person, right? Not necessarily erasing the indelible scars, but, you know, beautifying them in the same way that you would beautify a piece of broken china, pouring gold inside of the cracks in order to make it a work of art. And that was the part that I loved about it. You know, just, wow, you know, I was able to finally, you know, tell this story, but also give direction, use platform in a way that I always thought was meaningful. You know, here you are with, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers on all your social media platforms, and you want to be able to continue to be a light in this world of darkness. You don't want to use platform to, you know, so to speak, like I wrote this hook to this song, Hands Up, Don't Shoot, Slave Codes Again, Buck Dancing, Thought We Was Prancing, We're Seen As 3/5 of a Man, I'm Fighting to Live, Fighting to Give, Fighting to Raise My Kids, I Just Want This to End. And it was talking about the oppression that I had experienced back when I wrote that, but we are still experiencing that. Those same lyrics are relevant today because we have not yet been given the true equity that we need in this country, the opportunity to be, right? The opportunity to be seen as psychosocially necessary in society, in community. And I think those things are things that really make us more valuable when we say, I am going to, instead of, and in spite of, you know, I can say I am ugly, or I can say I am possible. Because whatever you say after the I am, you begin to give birth to.
We all dread the what should we have for dinner question. I know I do. I love a home-cooked meal, but I don't always have the time, energy, or groceries to make it happen. Being able to feast on a delicious meal without the long prep and cook times is what drew me to Home Chef over the other guys. Home Chef's meals are effortless, so I can spend less time trying to be top chef and more time watching it. Whether you prefer classic meal kits with pre-portioned ingredients and easy instructions, speedy recipes ready in less than 30 minutes, oven-ready kits with pre-chopped ingredients, or quick microwave meals that assemble in minutes, Home Chef has you covered for delicious meals without the hassle. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. Home Chef has over 30 options a week and serves a variety of dietary needs, so you never have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life. And of course, free shipping on your first box. Go to homechef.com/feverdream. That's homechef.com/feverdream for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard that right. Homechef.com/feverdream. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
As I was reading, I felt myself like radicalizing, reminding me of the moments in which I've been told by society, by individuals, that I'm inferior, that my blackness is inferior. While I was going through the book, at the same time, I noticed that there was a very distinct absence of a character that very often shows up in novels around oppression, which is like the good white person. That character never showed up. And I was wondering, do you think that readers of different racial backgrounds are going to get different messages from the story? And should they?
That's a very good question. A lot of these social justice book does that, has that noble white savior. And I didn't want that. Neither did Yousef, because while there were people, I think the Innocence Project was very instrumental in the Central Park Five. Is that correct? Central Park Five case?
That is correct. And I'm just, you know, just full transparency. That is correct towards the end of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the Innocence Project had its great, the power of the Innocence Project started in 1989. In the same, so to speak, time frame as we were going and being railroaded by the system. But by the time the truth was coming out, they were able to help and participate and, you know, get behind this story in a way that we had needed, you know, but that wasn't there necessarily in the beginning.
So I think in Amal's very tiny world, in his small world before his story makes it out, you know, the white people in his world fail him. That is his lawyer, his teacher. I still don't know if the social worker in Miss Cheryl Ann Buford is white or black. I'd leave it up to the reader to decide. But this is a situation where, for many of us, we don't have white saviors. There are no white saviors. This is something that's relegated to movies or books. So I wanted to make this as real as possible, where the saviors in Amal's life are from his community. And even there's a CO who's hostile, you know, and that's a reality. That is actually the CO that you're there, not to give too much away. It was something real that Yousef experienced.
No.
So with a tattoo. Yeah, I didn't make that up.
Oh my God, I was going to ask. And I was like, girl, you should not ask. You should not ask.
Tattoo is real.
Well, no, that was a part of trauma that was, like, it was completely I wasn't ready, you know. And then you see this and you say to yourself, wait, what? And you look up and the person is like, yeah. And you know, you know they're saying, yeah, that's right. This is what we're about. You know what it is. And you're so stunned, you're silent, and you conform because you realize that the power is them, right? They have the ability to open your cell and come and get you. They have the ability to disappear you, right? They have the ability to turn you into a hashtag, which is one of the main reasons why I think now, especially after Sandra Bland, there's been so many women and so many people just in general that have said, if I get arrested or if something happens to me, please know I didn't kill myself. You know, we're giving that that legacy prior to any unfortunate event, you know, and I think that that's important, but that's very real. There's so many people throughout the state of America, I would say throughout America, but definitely New York, where I'm from, who can attest to that, who know about those tattoos, you know, who talk about the fact that this was not just a good old boys club, but these were families that had profited from being a part of the prison industrial complex. These are families that when you look at the 13th Amendment, which is, it begins to become not fiction, but it feels fictitious when you read the 13th Amendment. It feels like they're not really. And then you realize, no, they are. Where are our black men? Where have they been? But more importantly, this discussion, like we were talking about, is not just about the prison industrial complex, but it's about the other big ticket issues. Gentrification, redlining. What happens through that? What is happening? What has happened? Oh, wow, it's still happening, right? This is part of that well thought out, well planned, 100-year, 1,000-year in perpetuity plan designed to keep slavery, to keep oppression, to keep states' rights to exist by any other name, you know? And I think that that's the part that's the scariest, that when you finally wake up, you know, you want the American dream. And now you're awakened to the American nightmare.
So there are no white saviors here. Yeah.
Something that I found so incredibly powerful about the book is that, you know, it acknowledges that for a lot of young black men, there's an element of something about this experience that is almost predestined, that is out of their control. And at the same time, it gets across what a profound interruption this is in a young person's life, that they had a very full life and their future that they were looking forward to. And I think it gets across both the contrast of it being, in a sense, something that was this person moving through in the world was going to have a tremendously difficult time avoiding, but also, yeah, like I said, just what a insane, intense interruption it is for such a young life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It seems like we've all had those types of experiences, you know, and I think the great thing about this story too, you know, Punching the Air, although there's a African American or African in America on the cover, you know, it has all of those other kaleidoscopic elements in it, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that that's the beauty of this story, that it's beautiful. The cover is beautiful. They say you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt, and that it's not just because it's us, but this cover is a great representation of what's in the book. And as you begin to flip through the pages, you begin to see, wow, the pages are beautiful. There's art on the actual copies. The advanced reader copies may not have all of the artistry inside of it, but there's art in the book. There's beauty in the book. There is, you know, you can take different pieces of the book out and just look at them and just sit them there and say, wow, you know, and I think this is something that I'm very proud of to have worked on with Evie. This is perfect.
Yeah, and the art and the value of art in young people's lives and the power, is that's not an accidental feature of the book. That's a huge part of it, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's beautiful art in the final copy. You have to get a hardcover too.
I will. It's ordered. It's pre-ordered. Again, the book Punching the Air comes out on September 1st. And I believe the audiobook is also read by the young man who plays the younger version of you in the film, or in, excuse me, When They See Us.
Yes, Ethan Harisi is the voice behind the audiobook of Punching the Air. Yes, that part was a really fun, amazing, powerful piece that we were able to pull in as well. We love that part.
Yeah, absolutely.
Amazing. Thank you guys so much for being so generous with your time and experiences.
Well, thank you. I'd like to say I'm a Brooklyn girl.
Hey, Brooklyn.
Brooklyn's in the house. So thank you for all your time, and from New Yorker to New Yorkers.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed.
The Betches Sup podcast is produced by Sean Kilby and Amanda Duberman. Our podcast managers are Mike Coscarelli and Sean Kilby. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Artwork by Brittany Levine. Be sure to follow us at Betches_Sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send your emails to sup@betches.com.
Betches.